After 15 months in the dark, the Abbey Theatre opened its doors last night to actual people, a real audience, for Rúna McEvitt's new comedy play, One Good Turn. The play revolves around a family under pressure. Bosco Hogan is the ailing paterfamilias in need of intensive care from his wife, Catherine Byrne, and occasionally from daughters Liz Fitzgibbon and Aveen McCann. That is, the actors and actresses playing the parts of those particular characters. Shane O'Reilly is the neighbour. Pam Boyd as the home help complete the cast. Chris Morrish was there for us last night and he joins me now. Do you know, Chris, I suppose we could spend at least 20 minutes talking about what was it like to get back inside a theatre? It must have been very exciting. Just the action of sitting in a seat and actually looking at a play up on a stage in front of you with others around you.
Oh, I mean, Sean, it was far too exciting. I mean, I was embarrassing. I mean, I got there way too early. I took a selfie of myself in my seat. You know, I did all those things you don't do in the theater because I was just excited to be back. You know, I mean, I think it's the first time I've been to a play where the story in the Irish Times the next morning was about the audience.
Well, yes, and of course, never mind the selfie in the seat. You were in the picture in the Irish Times, sitting in your seat by yourself, quite distance from everybody else.
I was, yeah. No, I mean, it was a very strange experience, but it just felt, you know, felt like coming home in a funny way. But it felt safe. I mean, I suppose that's the main thing to say. You go into the theater, you're escorted to your seat. I mean, I had enough space around me. I could put on my own play. You're escorted from your seat when the play is over. You wear a mask the whole time. Yeah, you miss all the, you know, the interaction at the interval, but just to be back in live theater, it was worth it.
Yeah, because I guess really an opening night, normally it would be the kind of the glitz and the glamour of that. And there is a certain frisson on an opening night, you know, with family and friends and supporters there, but also the actors and the writer and the director and all the rest, knowing that the critics are in to make their judgments as well. But I guess that was probably, was it, you know, you didn't miss that because this was the first night back in, as I say, 15 months.
Absolutely, yeah, yeah. Look, I mean, you recognize this is the way it is, and perhaps the way it's going to be for a little while. But still, just to see live theater, and just to remember, you know, just what it's like to watch people there in front of you on the stage live. It was worth it. I mean, it's difficult. I think it's probably difficult for the actors, and I think they dealt with it really well. And, you know, I think, I mean, we can talk about this in terms of, with a comedy, you know, with a comedy as an actor, you play off the energy of the audience that, you know, you've got a line right or a gag right when you get that immediate roar of laughter. And you sort of feel self-conscious laughing sometimes. And that's a bit tricky.
Yeah, because sometimes, I mean, in a small, if there's a small house, as in there's a small crowd, the people, the front of house staff might say, could you all move down to the front here so that everybody's clumped in together, and there can be something wonderfully intimate about that, and the actors can play to that small number of people all together. But this was a small number of people quite spaced out in the auditorium. And I suppose if we talk a little bit about the nature of Una McEvitt's play, One Good Turn, it really is in the realms of realistic realism and comedy. That's where we are.
Absolutely. I mean, the set actually reminded me of the house that my wife's family grew up in Glasnevin Avenue in Dublin. Realistic suburban house in a neighborhood that has aged, you know, in a neighborhood where everybody bought their houses maybe in the 1960s or 70s. And now everybody is retired. And that's the world we're in. And as you said in your intro, it focuses around this character played by Bosco Hogan Frank, who has, I think it's emphysema, so needs 24-hour care, which is provided largely by Catherine Byrne, and with varying degrees of usefulness by his daughters, played by Liz Fitzgibbon, Fiona, and the character of Aoife, played by Aveen McCann. So, yeah, that's the world we're in.
And is it? It's very much the family dynamic that we're looking here between the siblings and the care that is now needed by the father of the family. That's the area we're looking at.
Yeah, it's a very carefully constructed play, and it's a very subtly put together play, because it's not a play about plot. It's really a play about character relationships, about character. And it's when the play is over that you realize, and that makes sense, because it's a play in which we have a character at the center of it, this character Frank, who has very little that happens in his life. So it's a play in which not a lot can happen. But when it's over, you realize the main event of the play is actually taken place off stage with a character we never see. The neighbor, the mother of the character played by Shane O'Reilly, Kieran's mother, who is taken to hospital and goes into a coma. And it kind of happens quietly off stage. And that, you realize, is the main event of the play.
And is you won't want to give too much away here, but are we talking about difficulties around COVID with Kieran's mother, or do we get into that area? Does it stand alone from the pandemic?
Yes, no, you never quite know what it is that has I mean, she's 98 years old, so she's probably prey to a lot of ailments. So no, we don't actually know, and we're given very little detail of it. And it works in relation to COVID in very interesting ways, because it never references COVID explicitly at all. But that sense of a family, inhabiting the same space and kind of getting on one another's nerves and being on top of one another is something that I think probably a lot of families can identify with over the last 15 months.
And not only the usual families getting on top of each other, but maybe situations where family have come home for various reasons and are all in the same house, adult children and the parents as well. And that adds to that dynamic. And that's there particularly, I think, Chris, in the relationship between Aoife, the character played by Eoin McCann, and Fiona, the character played by Liz Fitzgibbon.
That's right. Yeah, Aoife, the situation is Aoife has just arrived home for a wedding, and she had a boyfriend in London. She lived in London, and she's broken up with the boyfriend. Of course, the whole family love the boyfriend. They adore the boyfriend. They think he's fabulous, and she's broken up with him. So this creates a kind of a dynamic. And then there's the other daughter at home, Fiona, played by Liz Fitzgibbon, who has had a job and has just given it up and is in the same sort of rut almost as her father and her mother. And all of them are kind of, caught up in this kind of sense of kind of stasis, but we have it's real ensemble playing. It's a lovely piece in that there's no kind of lead role in it. They kind of change leads back and forth, and all really solid playing.
Well, let's listen to a clip featuring both Eoin McCann and Liz Fitzgibbon then, and a little exchange around the whole thorny subject of "and what are you working at now?" A question that might make the blood run cold for many people.
I was actually trying to think of a career that might suit you on the flight over.
Oh, you were you? This should be good.
I was thinking you might make a good poet.
A poet? Right.
Well, what do you think?
Think it's a little late now to try and make a living writing poems.
You used to write great poems when we were kids.
You did.
Oh, yeah? Well, you'll find something else to do.
I am doing nothing for a while.
Do you think...
What?
Do you think you might...
Do you think I might...
Do you think you might be depressed or something?
Is that what Brenda said?
No. No one said anything.
Because I'm not.
Okay, well, that's good.
Hold on. Are you depressed?
No. I just thought I'd ask if you were...
That's Eoin McCann as Aoife, Liz Fitzgibbon as Fiona in a scene there from Una McKevitt's play that opened at the Abbey Theatre last night, the play called One Good Turn. Chris Morrish was there for us. It struck me listening to that, and from the bits that I wasn't in the audience as you were, because I was here last night, Chris, but I did see some of it online today. The Abbey very kindly gave me a chance to look at some of that. And it struck me very much. It's not that far off the world of Bernard Farrell in that there are very funny sections to it, but it can kind of twist and turn into something a little bit more serious at times as well. Where does Una McKevitt strike that balance? Do you think it's a comedy with a little bit of seriousness, or a serious point being made with some comedy to sugar the pill?
Yeah, I mean, she once described her work as art disguised as entertainment, and I think that's quite a good description. If you could just sit down and you watch it, and it's a comedy, and it's funny, and it's got some great gags and it's some really funny lines, and then you realize it is dealing with serious things about quality of life, and just the way families interact with one another. And I suppose what it reminded me of in some ways was something even closer to home, or more recent, was Roddy Doyle's Two Pints, where you have this play where you have two men, talking over pints in a kind of Roddy Doyle way, and then you realize they're talking, in some ways they're talking about cancer and they're talking about death. But if you said it was a play about cancer and death, you probably wouldn't go and see it. And yet it's very funny. And I think it's that sort of territory. It's very much part of what Graham McLaren and Neil Murray have done in The Abbey, is, you know, to put on plays that are entertaining, that are funny, and yet they're dealing with issues that are actually serious.
Yeah, so it from what you're saying, you feel that Una McKevitt and Emma Jordan, both of whom are having their debuts on the main stage of the Abbey here, Una McKevitt as a writer and Emma Jordan as a director, it sounds as if together they have found that balance between serious and comedy and managed it well.
They have. I mean, it's a very tightly put together show. And as I say, to do a comedy without that kind of wave of energy that you get from an audience is a tough thing to do. And they do it very, very seamlessly. And I do think it's there's a lovely symbolism to the reopening of the Abbey, you know, this first audience back in. And we have both the writer, Una McKevitt, and the director, Emma Jordan. It's their first time on the main stage, rather than going with, you know, a kind of Abbey classic. I think that's a really nice gesture.
Yeah, and I suppose we will be having the new regime. Katrina McLaughlin will be in there as artistic director very soon as well. So I suppose there is newness to come in that respect as well. Sounds as if you had a good time, apart from being quite understandably childlike and excited about being back in the theatre. But it sounds as if when you put that to the one side, you still had a good evening, Chris.
I did. And as I say, it's a very subtly put together play. And I think, you know, you just sort of enjoy it, and then you come out afterwards and you think, oh, there's all that other things going on as well. So yes, no, I did. I think it's a very nicely put together play. And I think it's a play, I can see it as a play that other companies will pick up. I think, you know, it has that kind of solidity as a play. I think we'll see this play again in the future. And I'm looking forward to seeing more of what Una McKevitt does in the future. Mm.
All right. So a recommendation for you. And it's a little bit over an hour long, Chris.
80 minutes, no interval. You're not dare let you out into the lobby or up to the bar.
Yeah.
And it's also live streaming as well. So I think there's a live stream.
There are opportunities, to see both ways.
26th. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
I have the details of that here. But thanks for being with us. And a little bit jealous of you getting into a theatre, but I suppose my day will come for that one too, Chris. Thanks for sharing.
We'll all be back again someday, Sean.
We will, for sure. Chris Morris there speaking to us about Una McKevitt's One Good Turn, which is at the Abbey through until the 26th of June via live stream or in person. You can get full details of how you get tickets to go or how you watch it online on the Abbey website. It'll be available on demand from the 27th of June right through until the 10th of July. abbeytheatre.ie for full details on that. Morgana McIntyre from Belfast, Gemma Doherty from Derry met in Trinity College in Dublin in 2014. After graduation, they decided that they would stay that summer in the city to pursue music. Between Morgana's lyrics, Gemma's soundscapes, their voices met right in the middle and Saint Sister was formed. Their debut LP, Shape of Silence, was met with great critical acclaim, nominated for the Choice Music Prize. And their second album, Where I Should End, is out this Friday, which I had a great time listening to today. And I'm delighted to be joined by Morgana and Gemma to tell me more now. Morgana, you were given the success of Shape of Silence, where you'd spent that time at meeting at college and all of those things, and spent time making the album together and spending the summer together making music afterwards. This was a very different experience, the making of Where I Should End. You were in very different parts of the country for the making of Where I Should End, Morgana.
Yeah, we were out in Wicklow in the Meadow Studios in Delgany for this one. And the whole process was, as you said, very different. The first one, we made it with the three of us and Alex Ryan, who we co-produced with. And it was a very insular process. And we kind of needed that because we were learning so much. So we needed to make those mistakes in like private company, I guess. But once we did it once, I think our confidence was a bit higher. And we just kind of... Yeah, we thought we'd go for it, and we invited a lot more people in. We had the Crash Ensemble, String Quartet and Double Bass and Lisa Hannigan, and it just felt like a very open process. And yeah, it was gorgeous taking the trip out to Delgany every day as well.
And did you manage then, Gemma, to actually do this? You were at some point during lockdown, before or after, in the middle of it, when you could actually all be in the same studio together?
So luckily this was actually just finished. Probably at the start of March 2020, we were doing final mixes. So the process, the musical part of this wasn't disrupted by the lockdown, but then it was just the bringing it out part that we that became somewhat
that became somewhat disrupted, yes. Which is maybe explains why we're getting it at this point in time. And I'll just stick with you if I can on this one, Gemma. You know, the success of Shape of Silence, sometimes that, you know, when a first album goes really well, it puts shock and pressure on you for the second one. Did you feel any of that?
We did a bit, like, I think just from ourselves mostly. And our first album kind of took us a while, so we actually felt a bit of pressure with that one as well, because we'd released an EP and a few singles, and we'd already started touring quite a bit by the time that one came out. So it almost feels like we had it more with the first album. The second album, we just went for it a bit more, and I think we got it done a bit quicker, and we were kind of happier with our process and progress. So yeah, I think we kind of felt that in a bit more the first time around.
Right. I'm sure there'll be a different type of pressure when the third one comes along too. Let's listen to a song called Manchester Air. Tell us a little bit about this as we head into it, Morgana.
So we wrote it around the time of the repeal referendum. We were in Ayrshire at the time, and we wrote it before, I think the week before the vote was in, and then performed it, went back to the island and performed it afterwards. And it's about a young couple's story of an unwanted pregnancy and what they have to do and the decisions that they have to make.
From the back of your bike, I told you I was late. You said I can't go much faster. I said no, not like that.
A little bit there of Manchester Air, one of the songs from Saint Sister on the new album Where I Should End. I wanted to get to that section, Morgana, in the song where we hear that, I think it's stamping of feet and clapping of hands. There's a real sense of almost marching forward in protest, in a type of protest song in that aspect. Am I picking up on something for myself, or did you intend that to be there?
No, I'm glad it comes across that way, but I guess there's a few layers to it, as there is to the song. And I think those claps and the stomps really came from us singing it together. And at that point, the verse gets a little bit livelier. We sing into a bit more. It's a little bit more jovial. That's kind of a looking back and a happier memory. So we just started stamping and clapping as if we were in a bit of a session. And then those claps and stamps kind of fade out because the last verse is a little bit more serious and a little bit sadder. But I think, yeah, it's great that there's a few different layers there, and that political thing comes through as well.
And the other thing about it, Jim, I'm sure, I think you were in with us at the time of the first album, and I'm sure I asked you it then, but I'll ask it again. Anyway, there must have been a moment. We hear it in the harmonies at the beginning of that. We also hear it beautifully on the song The Place That I Work, where you have Lisa Hannigan as well, the three of you together. In fact, the harmonies are amazing. But when yourself and when Morgana, am I speaking to Gemma now or Morgana? I can't remember who started addressing this to. I'll go with you, Gemma, on this one. Was there a moment when the two voices, when you know, in a session or some point in college when you went, listen to our voices together, they sound amazing? Or did people say to you, listen to your voices, listen how they meld together and mould together?
It's a funny one. We have really different voices, like the two of us. They're completely, like, tonally very different. So I remember when we started writing music and playing together, we didn't really, like, I didn't know how that would work. And we started singing together a lot in unison, which was nice, you know, not always going for the harmony and just kind of letting the two meld into one another. And they kind of took on, like, a texture of its own. They are quite different from each other. So it's interesting the way that worked out.
Yeah, and the other thing that you, I suppose you both bring different aspects to it. Am I right in thinking, Gemma, that you're the the fan of Philip Glass and Steve Reich and people like that, because there's a track on the album called Irish Hour, and there's a big string section in the middle of that. I presume that's where the Crash Ensemble are involved. And it really reminded me that it had that Philip Glass, Steve Reich feel to it.
Oh, lovely. Yeah, I'd be a big fan of those guys. So that's a really nice reference.
So you wanted that to be there. And Morgana, you're the harpist, aren't you?
No, Gemma's the harpist.
Oh, Gemma's the harpist. I can't ask her another question about you'll feel left out. You met at Trinity College, and I believe you were the year behind Sally Rooney.
Yeah.
Now, are you a Connell or are you a Marianne? Are you none of the characters in Normal People? I'm going to you, Morgana.
I would say I'm more of a Connell without the ga talent, perhaps.
But, I'd say without the ga shirt.
And the shorts and the chain, but everything else, the charm. they're great books. We were the year behind her, but we didn't know her. But it's scary how much our reality of college was reflected in the books and the TV series as well.
I don't know what to say to that one. Certain parts of it, I'm sure. Gemma, which are you then? Are you a bit of a Connell as well, did you say?
Yeah, I'd say so, yeah. I think we both had that experience of like coming to Dublin and being like, whoa, this is, you know, not what you had in your head, which things often aren't, yeah. But I know we both very much felt that. And we didn't meet each other till 5 years after that, but I know we both coming down from the north, from different parts like Derry and Belfast, but I know we both shared that experience and reflected on it years later.
And I suppose that is very much Connell's experience in the story as well, isn't it? Yeah. Which of you is the big, I'm sure you're both Joni Mitchell fans, which of you is the bigger Joni Mitchell fan?
Oh, I being her all the time. I'm obsessed with Joni Mitchell. Morgan.
It's Morgana. Yeah. Grace. So I can stick with you for this one. Oh My God, Oh Canada then on the album. We celebrated, don't know if you heard last night, the 50th anniversary of Joni Mitchell's album Blues today. We celebrated it last night on the show. So Oh My God, Oh Canada is, I suppose, in some ways a direct reference to her, is it?
Yeah, her lines are just rolling around my head all the time. And we were in Canada and I was thinking about her a lot. And we wrote that song and it just felt like a little homage to her.
Yeah, well, we'll finish up with a bit of that. But before I do that, you're hoping for a few live shows in November, dates in the UK and around Ireland, Gemma?
We are, yeah. They're booked in, Ireland and the UK in November. And fingers crossed they go ahead. We're really looking forward to getting back out there
and then the pressure will start for album number 3.
Oh, it's already started.
It's already started. Listen, great to speak to the both of you this evening, and it's a really, from what I've been listening to today, I really, really enjoyed listening to the album and looking forward to getting back and listen to it some more. But I'll finish up with a bit of then Oh My God, Oh Canada from Saint Sister and the new album, which is called Where I Should End. Oh My God, Oh Canada from Where I Should End, new album from Saint Sister, and very enjoyable it is. They Come Then, The Birds is a new body of work from artist Amanda Coogan. It's commissioned by Rua Red Gallery in Dublin as part of the Magdalene series, where artists have been asked to respond to the gospel or mythical figure of Mary Magdalene. And Amanda Coogan is with me this evening. Again, I was kind of thinking, if I start saying the many things that are attached or that people have attached to Mary Magdalene, the interview will be over, because you could go on forever, couldn't you?
I could actually fill the whole programme and longer talking about the myth and the understanding of Mary Magdalene. And Rua Red commissioned me and a gang of artists who I'll tell you all about now in a minute. There's five of us all together, and they commissioned us in 2018, and it was a glorious process because it was straight away about the research. So they brought Lisa Godson in, they brought Marina Warner in, they brought Siobhan Garrigan in to talk to us about this idea. But of course, here in Ireland, we hear Magdalene, and of course, we link it with the laundries.
Yeah.
And you can peel it back and back and back to the great dichotomy of our of accepted understandings of what women should be. Virgin whore. Mary, the Virgin Mary, Mother of God, and Mary Magdalene. She was a composite, but she was seen as the penitent Protestant. A Protestant?
Now there's a Freudian slip.
Excuse me. The penitent. How do you say that word? Prostitute.
That's how you say
that's
it.
That's the one. I think I'm going to have a heart attack. I'm so sorry. But so we all know this, and we had this glorious series of lectures about that, and really considering the figure or the myth and all the things that's going on. And 3 years later, don't ask me how I stepped into this story of the Wrens of the Curra.
Well, let's go to that, because this picks up on, I suppose, there are so many other aspects, and I'll come back to ask you about, did Mary Magdalene write a gospel of her own? Was she the apostle to the apostles? All of those things.
Megan Waterson gave us a lecture, amazing lecture, available online on the Rural Red website, and she absolutely has found Mary Magdalene's gospel. The interesting thing is there was more than four gospels. It was some pope or other, and excuse my poor history making here, that decided just four of them would be published.
Yeah.
But there is seemingly, and a couple of copies of Mary Magdalene's gospel. But wait till I tell you, I am literally stink to high heavens because I've just come from the gallery, and the glamour of installing is amazing because I've literally been taking furze bushes out of the back of a lorry today with the fabulous bog and muck and smell of Glenismole. I didn't go to the Curra. I went to the most amazing farmer called Donnie Anderson, who gave us ladened furze bushes, which I'm hanging upside down and we're displaying in the gallery, because there's the most amazing story of these women who lived in the furze bushes.
In the Curra of Kildare.
In the Curra.
Yeah, and that's why you're saying you didn't go to the Curra, but nevertheless, this is about these Wrens. What period in history are we talking about?
They're kind of mid-19th century, post-famine, and just pre the Venereal Diseases Act, which of course led to the Magdalene laundries and that kind of filtering of women who were too promiscuous or who were trading in prostitution at the time. But they lived in what they called nests in the Curra, so just outside the British Army camp there. And can you, I mean, the gloriousness of it. All last year, I have furze at the end of my road where I live, and all last year I'd be up there with the dog, just looking at these beautiful bushes, and they're so mad. They're thorny. They're kind of scattered everywhere and scrub bushes. They're kind of neglected. They're kind of outsiders as well. And kind of imagining women who actually lived in these bushes in abject poverty. Like, there's an amazing eyewitness account of them from the Pall Mall Gazette in 1867, which really informed a lot of these things. But of course, you know, contemporary art is all about this wonderful, rich research. But then I have to kind of fling it out and make contemporary art, you know. Yes. So I got seven amazing women up in the furze bushes in Belfast, actually quite close to my home, as I say. And I shot them, and we are recording each other making these actions on mobile phones. And so we're intersecting a lot of now and then. And of course, I wanted to have a little look at the COVID moment. Sorry to mention the C word. And of course, beautifully, Mary Magdalene, famously, Jesus said to Mary Magdalene, Nolle me tangerine, I'm going to say now because I'm literally going with tangere. The wrong word. Tangere, thank you so much. Which means don't touch me or touch me not, which also fitted into this beautiful COVID moment where all of those things are happening. So we sign that to each other in sign language. My work is littered with sign language. And in this film, I have twins who are conjoined, and one of them signs in BSL, British Sign Language, and the other signs in ISL, telling us that they're telling us a story, and not I may.
With the two languages right beside
with the two languages literally intertwined and intersected, not a million miles away from my COVID job last year as a sign language interpreter up in Stormont.
Yes,
but,
and in that case,
side by side with the
both
BSL.
Both languages were absolutely, signed together.
Absolutely.
Side by side.
So it is a kind of a knitting. I feel like the piece is a glorious kind of soup that I keep adding bits of ingredients to, but I can't tell you. Come into the gallery is stinking to high heavens of furze bushes at the moment. It's absolutely glorious.
Can I have a listen to a little bit of the soundtrack?
Oh, that's Mary Barnicot has made the most glorious.
You put on your headphones and we can listen to a little bit, and you can talk as we're listening. So just tell us what we're hearing. Are you hearing that there? You are.
Oh, yeah. I am. Yeah. So Mary is Mary and the Pigeons. She's the cellist. And so she's made this glorious soundtrack for us. And what's happening on the film, on the performance film here, is that we are flickering our hands. I suppose this is all my choreography in inverted commas, that it comes through sign language. And the twins, as I'm calling them, the BSL and ISL signers, are telling us constantly, I'm telling you a story, and they're bickering with each other. No, I'm telling you a story. No, I'm telling you the story. Yeah. And actually, the story's going on behind with all of the images of what the other wrens, which I've called, are doing.
Let's have a listen to it then, just by itself. Give it a bit of space for itself. Section there from Mary Barnicot's soundtrack for The Wrens of Kildare. They Come Then, The Birds is the title of this new body of work, Amanda. Just where does that quote come from?
I think it's a bastardization of a Seamus Heaney line from some poem or other. Do you know, because I've been running at this and gloriously in that kind of dream time of the lockdown in the last year and a half, I kept gathering bits and pieces and now I've forgotten where they came from. But I think I fiddled with the line of poetry, which is always... But I wanted to bring in the birds because they're wrens and they're...
Well, of course, the wrens have, you know, isn't that the reference to the wrens in the war as the kind of the nurses who looked after the soldiers, which is kind of what these women were doing in this in another, of Kildare,
yes, absolutely.
Looking after the soldiers in a different way.
Yes, servicing, if we take a veterinary
term
to put it there. There is brilliant gossipy story of the then Prince of Wales being serviced by a very famous wren called Nellie Clifton, who this was Victoria and Albert's son Edward, who went on to be Edward the Seventh, who had a little dalliance, quite a serious dalliance with one of the wrens, that he was lifted home a couple of weeks later once his parents found out. And Victoria seemingly, and then Albert died very suddenly straight afterwards, and Victoria seemingly never forgave Edward for taking up with an Irish floozy.
Oh, right, so that was what
killed the gossip.
That's what killed his father.
Well, that's, you know.
Went home and told the story.
How powerful are those wrens?
Yeah, for sure. But you had dealt with the Mary Magdalene earlier in your work as well. This is Mary Magdalene in Ecstasy, Yellow.
Yes, absolutely. Well, Yellow, definitely. Yellow is a very important piece of mine that kind of looks at the Laundries, I suppose, and Emma have just bought it as a live performance, which is really incredible to add a live performance to their collection, to a national collection. I'm deeply, deeply honoured. But before that, actually, I had made a piece. I was looking at Caravaggio, and Caravaggio has this magnificent painting of Mary Magdalene in ecstasy. So there is a little frisson of sexuality in it. And so I made a live work around that. But since then, Alice Marr and Rachel Fallon, who were two of the other artists on this list, introduced me to Artemisi Gentileschi. And I'm probably pronouncing that wrong.
I'll take that.
A female painter who painted another Mary Magdalene in ecstasy. Very similar pose to the Caravaggio one. And she's very much... We can read a female ecstatic sexual moment. One could read that into Gentileschi's work completely. Now, let me tell you, because I'll be murdered if I don't mention the other artists. I feel like a party political broadcast here because once one is mentioned.
You've said nearly all of them at this point, have you?
I know. So I kick off this Magdalene series, which is curated by Melissa Boyle, of Rue Red, absolutely amazingly. And next is Alice Marr and Rachel Fallon. They'll be in September. And Jessie Jones and Grace Diaz will be coming in. So it'll be a year-long look, us artists looking at this figure and how it comes out about.
Yeah. Great project.
Stunning.
And I think how you're starting it off and that connection with the Wrens of Kildare, wonderful way to start it. Great to speak with you.
Great to see you, Amanda. Great to talk to you too.
It's Amanda Coogan talking to us about They Come Then, the Birds, which is part of the first exhibition in the series, which Amanda was telling us about, launches Friday the 25th of June, 6 p.m. The Magdalene series will continue through until 2022. Exhibitions and interventions by, as Amanda told us, Alice Maher, Rachel Fallon, Jesse Jones and Grace Dias. And you can find out full details of everything that's happening on ruared.ie. Tomorrow, Wednesday, June 23rd, is a big day for the people of University Concert Hall Limerick, as for the first time in many moons, they will welcome live audiences back to the venue. I'm so delighted that that is going to be, I hope, one of the stories that we'll be talking about in many venues over the summer, and hopefully it will continue beyond the summer as well. What better music to lift the spirits than the sounds of Argentinian tango master Astor Piazzolla? 19th century German violinist and composer Bernhard Malik performed by the Irish Chamber Orchestra, which will be led by Catherine Honka. I'm delighted to have Catherine join us on the programme this evening. In fact, we spoke with yourself and Dermot about this project back in when it was kind of being launched, Catherine. I remember there was a wonderful response to the music that we played on the programme that evening. So I will play a little bit of Oblivion later on, which I didn't get to play properly on that particular occasion. But you didn't know at that stage that you would ever get be at the point where this might be performed in front of a live audience sitting in the auditorium in front of you?
Exactly. So when we did that interview, then we were trying to get excited, as all musicians have been trying to do, about recording and broadcasting, which we've all had to kind of put our hearts and souls into. But in actual fact, we're going to play to real humans tomorrow. Can you believe that?
Yeah. There must be, even in rehearsals, I'm sure that has brought a kind of a frisson and an excitement to things.
God, you're absolutely right. I actually hadn't even thought of that. But the last 2 days, we've all been so incredibly buzzed up. And that's why, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because we're all, it's amazing buzz in the room.
We constantly get these warnings. Look, it's great that places are opening up and it's great that society is opening back up, but we need to be careful still. We need to take certain precautions. So what sort of precautions still have to be in place for the orchestra themselves?
Quite a lot, to be honest. I mean, we wear masks in all the rehearsals. So we're all tested before we work together. Mm. And then we're all wearing masks, even though we've all got negative test results. You know, it's super precautious. Super full of precautions, I should say.
Yes,
super cautious.
Super cautious.
And I suppose that's, you know, it just has to be that way, doesn't it? And then we're all 2 metres apart. So as well as those things I just said, we're also 2 metres apart. And tomorrow, the audience will all be massively apart.
Yeah, because the university, University Concert Hall Limerick is a big venue. You know, you could fit a lot of people in there, but I guess there will be very specific spaces between individuals that are there by themselves, and then if you're there as a group, I presume you will be in a little pod in a group together.
Yeah, exactly. So I think that there's only little groups of two, and if you come with three, then already you're spread out. That's just the way that they've done it.
Yeah,
but we're hoping to play to 200 people. And I mean, that sounds like a crowd to me.
Well, given
like
that,
in the old days, that would be like, oh, that's a shame. Where are the others? But tomorrow, I can't believe it's going to be that many people.
Yeah, I suppose given that you've been so used to live streaming, where for the most part you're looking at a camera person and possibly some sound people going around the place, 200 people is quite definitely a crowd.
It's going to be amazing. You know that moment when the music stops. It's going to be amazing not to have silence.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, you know, that energy in the room that happens that nobody can quite describe after the event. I cannot wait for that.
Yeah.
That thing where people just that thing you can't quite put your finger on, you know?
I know. And there's a moment that I'm kind of waiting for the next concert that I get to where it involves an orchestra, which is the moment of the orchestra tuning up. I imagine that with an audience present, even for the audience, that would be quite an emotional moment.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. Just that, or even the moment that we go out on stage, because we tend to make an entrance. We're not already on stage when the audience comes. So So that moment when we go out and see some of those familiar faces again, it's extremely emotional.
Yeah, except there won't be a dry eye in the house. I hope you
certainly will not. And then the music is a bit, is like pulls at the heartstrings.
Yeah, well, that's good to say. I hope the first piece that you play won't have the entire place in tears. Tell me a little bit, because we talked about Piazzolla the last time, and I'll get you to lead me into Oblivion shortly. But tell me a little bit about Bernhard Molik.
Yeah, well, he's not a famous composer, of course. I was actually asking Dermot Dunn, the accordionist, what else he wrote, and apparently he did write some other things. But this little piece for accordion and strings is incredibly beautiful. And Dermot as well, he has a way of weaving things into gold. So actually there won't be a dry eye in the house. It's full of tunes and very sentimental. It's really, it's very sweet. It's going to be bittersweet tomorrow, probably. It's beautiful.
That's the crying one for tomorrow night. Send me off then. I'll fade it up as you're telling me a little bit about Oblivion, the Piazzolla piece. Wonderful piece this as well, Catherine.
Yeah, Oblivion is it's a piece that I've lived with for all through lockdown. Actually, I've played it in many different ways over lockdown, but this is the recording that we released in 2019, when everything just went wrong, but the recording went right, I absolutely love playing this music. It's very hard to talk about it. It's one of those things. It gets the audience every time.
Yeah, well, let's
let. So I almost feel guilty playing it.
Well, enjoy that guilty pleasure tomorrow night, and enjoy. Oh, sorry, tomorrow afternoon, isn't it? Yeah, 2 p.m.
Tomorrow afternoon at 2 o'clock. Yeah,
enjoy.
And people can watch the live stream the next.
Of course,
night
from the NCH. Yeah, the NCH will be live streamed the following evening. But good luck in the concert in the University Concert Hall tomorrow night in Limerick, and enjoy having the audience back. Great to speak with you, Catherine.
Thank you so much.
Oh yes, the music of Astor Piazzolla there, Dermot Dunn with the Irish Chamber Orchestra, and oh, the lucky people that will get to see and hear that live tomorrow afternoon, 2 p.m. at the University Concert Hall. First time in front of a live audience since last Christmas for the Irish Chamber Orchestra. The concert in Limerick tomorrow in the afternoon. Full details at UCH.ie. You will get a chance to, if you can't do there and be there and get there, you can watch the live stream the following evening from the National Concert Hall in Dublin. The Irish Chamber Orchestra will, now that they've started back in front of audiences, two performances at the Kilkenny Arts Festival, where their orchestra in residence. We'll get the details of that soon. And in September, Strauss's Metamorphosen for 23 strings, Jörg Wittmann will be conducting there in the University Concert Hall.